What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. Kelly Baker, affectionately known as the Angry Filmmaker, is one of my favorite people. Not only is he a filmmaker, sound designer, and editor, but he is also an author, having penned several collections of short stories and nonfiction books. In this conversation, Kelly and I travel the shores of comfortable and uncomfortable topics, from the joys of eavesdropping and the curse of remembering too much, to influences and the origin of ideas. We talk a lot about his latest book of short stories, Dennis Barton is a Bastard, and other stories, telling the truth in art, and how to continue growing and evolving as an artist. Most importantly, Kelly preaches the gospel of independence and how every one of us can support independent artists with our time, money, and attention. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/548.
So I shouldn't have gotten a haircut yesterday?
No.
I want to look good.
Yeah. I want to look good on your podcast.
Yeah. All right, you're on.
All right, Kelly. Well, welcome back to Getting Work to Work. I think the last time you were on the show was probably within the first or second year. So three or four years later, welcome back.
Has it been that long? Wow.
It has been that long. Yeah, I think you were one of the first people that I actually didn't know that I had on the show.
Oh, that's cool. And now we're friends.
Exactly. Yeah. Now we've talked for about, you know, half hour before we hit record. Right. And we're all talked out. So, you know,
yeah,
this will be the shortest interview ever. 55 seconds.
There we go. I'm done. You have a great day. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. You too. Well, Kelly, one of the questions that I added since we first talked was the one I love asking everyone right out of the gate. And it's, what are you endlessly curious about?
That's such a good question. You know, I'm going to say people and circumstances, situations. I interviewed the writer Kay Boyle years ago. She's been gone for a long time. But one of her thoughts was, if you want to be a writer, if you really want to, you know, write well, you need to have a belief. You have to believe in something. And she always said that, you know, her belief was in people and that people would ultimately make the right choices. And I think my belief or my curiosity is about people, and I don't necessarily think they always make the right choices.
Isn't that the truth that we're seeing right now?
Yeah, but I still have this curiosity about getting to know people and different types of people and, you know, what makes them tick.
Have you always been that way?
Well, since my background, you know, as a filmmaker and doing documentaries and stuff, I'm going to say that I guess I probably have. I've always enjoyed interviewing people. And I learned how to interview actually from Studs Terkel.
I love that.
Because I got to interview him once. And, oh, man, you know, what I learned is to be a good interviewer, to really know about people, you have to give them your undivided attention. And if they know that and you ask questions based on not stuff that you've written down, but based on the conversation, you'll learn a whole lot more. And I you know, that was just mind-blowing to me. And it's like whenever I do interviews anymore now, yes, I have, you know, half a dozen questions, so I know where I want to take the conversation. But then I really try to sit and make eye contact, unless it's a podcast. But, you know, make eye contact and really listen and respond to what they're saying.
That's amazing. And I think there's so much wisdom in that. And I think it moves us beyond just, you know, oh, I love people. I love the people watch. But there's something about watching people, but then also taking the next step and then asking them about themselves or,
yes,
you know, wanting to dive into that underlying belief. I think that's a fascinating approach to it that Kay Boyle said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do find people fascinating. And I'm the worst eavesdropper in restaurants. You know, I pick up, my daughter does the same thing now too. And it's like, so we can sit there over a meal and never say a word, but walk out of there saying, did you hear this? Did you hear? You know, I think she's going to be a great writer too.
See, I knew I liked you for a very specific reason. I just couldn't put my finger on it until you mentioned eavesdropping, because my wife and I are the same way.
Oh, you learn so much about humanity.
Yes. Yes, you do.
And, you know, that gets into one of the stories in the new book started off as an eavesdrop conversation.
Really?
And that's the story, It's No Sin to Be Lonely. I was in a bar and I saw this woman who was obviously on a first date on one of those, you know, match.coms, whatever. And they were dumb enough to sit at the next table over. And so, you know, that's where the germ from that story came from, was the awkwardness and the other stuff. And then, you know, obviously I filled a lot of stuff in, from my own personal history or whatever, or experiences. But, you know, that gem of a story, that germ of the idea and everything came from hearing these two people, you know, awkwardly try to get to know each other.
So are you like sitting there next to them? Do you have like a photographic memory of what's been said? Or are you like making notes after they leave or after you leave?
I did come home that night and write down a bunch of stuff. The problem was I was in that bar with a friend of mine, and you know, once she realized that what I was doing, then she wanted to comment on what was going on. And it's like, you can't do that, because they eventually got up and moved tables because I think that they thought we were listening.
Oh.
And so, you know, she kind of blew my cover.
Oh no.
I seem to retain an awful lot, and I think it was all the years I spent as an editor. Mm-hmm. You know, because I can look at all the footage from a movie as I'm putting it together, and I'll remember where take one was, or take 17 was really good on that. And so I think maybe, you know, it's something I've developed over the years. But so I have a pretty good recall.
That's awesome. What a superpower.
You know, I wanted to be invisible or go through walls, but I remember too much.
You remember how the wall felt the first time you hit it.
Yes. I've still got some of those same scars. But yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting. I never thought about it as a superpower, but I'll take it, you know.
Yeah, because I remember reading about Walter Murch and, you know, how he would classify all of his shots with, you know, FileMaker Pro and photographs and all this stuff. It's nice that you have a photographic memory and recall.
Yeah, for that kind of stuff. Absolutely. Ask me what I had for dinner last night and I'm out. You know, so I guess I just remember the important stuff, like eavesdropping on other people's conversations.
So you've mentioned eavesdropping, you've mentioned running into walls and scars. Where else do you get your story ideas from?
It's a stupid thing to say everywhere, but you never know when an idea is going to hit. And that doesn't always mean it's a good idea. I've also had a lot of, I guess the best way to put it would be adventures. Most people say I've done a lot of stupid stuff.
Nah, I like adventure.
Yeah, me too. But I usually end up writing about some of that stuff. And some of my stories do come from, you know, dumb things that I did or adventures that I had. And I never, and this is something that somebody asked me about once, I have never looked at something coming up and saying, if I do this, that's going to be a good story. I've never done that. I've, you know, that looks interesting to do, or, you know, what the hell, I'm in the moment and, you know, and I go off and do whatever it is. And then much later, it's like, oh shit, that's going to make a good story. But that's always after the fact.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a story right now that happened years ago in Mexico, where I met up with these two people who were crazy and crazy drunk. We were drinking tequila, which is never a good idea. But I went on this, you know, they said, come on, we want to go play pool someplace. And it became this crazy, crazy, scary night. And I think that if I was with my now ex, but it's like, if we hadn't been also drinking tequila, there was no way in hell we would have gone and done this stuff.
Right.
Years later, I think I can fondly recall the memory because nobody got hurt. But you know, now that's the subject of a new story, which of course I will embellish, but that particular story does not need a lot of embellishment. That was pretty stupid. But so, yeah, I get ideas from everywhere. I get motivation from all over the place and, you know, and influence. And, you know, I like to think I'm a bit of a sponge, not to get people saying that, you know, there's no way in hell they want to have a conversation with me because I'm going to steal their stuff. Because I'm with my writing friends and all that stuff, you know, I'm really hardcore. If somebody says something to me that's really funny, you know, or whatever it is, you know, I always tell them, you know, that's yours. I'm not going to touch that. Because I've had a couple of friends former friends who take some things that I've told them or adventures I've told them and kind of turn them into stories. And it's like, no, that's not cool. But yes, I think I'm just a walking sponge to a certain extent.
I find the idea of influence really interesting.
Well, I think we're all influenced. You know, unless you're in a dark closet someplace, I mean, everything we look at, everything we see, you know, I go to art museums, I study paintings, I look at paintings to learn about lighting, about composition, about, you know, those things for that half of my brain. But I read so many other writers and, you know, and check out different things. And, you know, people always say, you know, what are the movies that influenced you or what are the books that influenced you? And to a certain extent, I think it's like, what didn't influence you? Because, you know, you might have read a book that was horrible and that influences you. I never want to write that like that, exactly. Or I never want to see something like that again.
Yeah.
But all these little things, it's, you know, little things pop up in your head when you're working. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have no idea where the hell they came from. And sometimes if you want to, you know, pull the string and trace it back, it's like, oh my God, that came from something I saw 37 years ago, you know? But I just think that, you know, when it comes to influences, and I guess the other half of the coin with them, the big part of that is you have to be open to them. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't live in this world with blinders on. You know, and knowing you as well as I do, you know, I know you're a reader. You watch things, you know, you do all these different things. And so I think, you know, we're the same in that we're both constantly trying to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that stuff that we're learning all the time works its way into our work, be it writing, be it podcasting, be it, you know, filmmaking, be it, you know, whatever. The stuff can't help but come into our work.
I think the best thing that I heard recently was I was reading the memoir of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Wow, yeah.
And he mentioned that he layers all of these influences on top of each other until it becomes unique to him. And I absolutely loved that way of thinking.
That's very cool. He is an original, and I love him. You know, I mean, he was so far ahead of his time, and then he's gone so far around the curve, but he still does amazing stuff. Yeah, I think that with all this stuff, you look at your influences, and you have to make them your own. You know, wasn't it Hunter Thompson who one of the ways he learned how to write was he retyped all these famous books?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, but until he could feel how words flowed, you know, and sentence structure and all that stuff. And then he obviously put his own spin on everything he did. But, you know, I mean, everybody, I think, approaches it in a different way. But we are all influenced, you know. You can walk out your front door and see something, you know, that moves you, strikes you, disgust, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, sooner or later, I believe that that can come up in your work in some way.
Absolutely.
God, you're making me sound deep.
Oh, good. Yeah. So one of the things that I'm curious about is how you feel about the shitty first draft.
Oh God. Oh God. One of the things I always used to tell people is I won't show draft 5 to my family and they love me. you know, my daughter and I go back and forth on this because she's my editor on a lot of stuff too. You know, maybe I rewrite too much, but I you know, the shitty first draft is supposed to be shitty. The second and third drafts are better, but not by much, because I think that you're still, in many instances, you're still finding the thread. You're still finding the story. You're still finding whatever it might be. And for me, I don't think it all really starts kicking in until about draft four or five. And then suddenly I know where I'm going. Because, you know, the scripts that I wrote and the screenplays that I wrote for my features, I'm going to say, I don't think I started casting until I was on draft 13 or 14.
Wow.
And then, you know, once you do read-throughs, you know, there's always that. So with the short stories and that kind of writing, I'm feeling like there's probably, the stories are all probably somewhere between draft 6 and 8 in that book. You know, and some people will laugh and say, that's not nearly enough. I should keep rewriting. And some people will say, oh, draft 2 is good enough. And it's like, no, it ain't.
Interesting.
You know, I'm trying to lure you in.
Right.
Right. With these stories. And that it takes a while to figure out, you know, how do you start a story? Where do you? And so, like I said, I love first drafts because, you know, they are shitty. But that's kind of that becomes the universe. And then you just have to start cutting out stuff or adding stuff and building on it.
It's a fantastic way to describe your book, too, because, you know, the book that we're talking about is Dennis Barton is a Bastard and Other Stories. And when I picked up the book and started reading it, it feels cinematic in the best possible way. I mean, you give me a taste of a world and then you move on before I get tired of it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm hoping after all these years of making films and stuff, my writing should be a little cinematic. One hopes.
But yeah, I mean, I love how much I get into the world and how much I actually enjoy the characters. Like, I feel like I get to know them even in like 8 pages.
Uh-huh. Cool. Thank you. I mean, because that's obviously, you know, what I'm striving for is to introduce you to these places or these people. And help you to see them or see their circumstances.
Yeah.
And for you, it sounds like I was successful.
Yeah, I would say you were.
Cool. Good. You're gonna give me a quote to use on the website, right?
Oh, absolutely. and the quote is this: yes, Dennis Barton is a bastard.
And since you and I both know how that story plays out, I appreciate that one. Yeah, he was. He was. But don't you feel better knowing now that you know why he's a bastard?
Yes. Well, I had to make sure that I read that story because I'm about halfway through the book. So I at least made sure that I read that story before our interview today because I had to know why he was a bastard.
You know, I wrote that story, called it that. And when I was trying to compile the book, my daughter said, you know what the book needs to be called? And I said, no, what? And she said, Dennis Barton is a Bastard. And I said, why? And she said, because everybody's going to want to know why.
Yes.
And she bought some book when she was in a bookstore called like So-and-So is a Slut or something. She said, I saw that book. And she said, it was a horrible book, but I had to buy it anyway because I wanted to know why she was a slut. Hmm. And so hopefully people will hear, see that title and think, okay, I want to know why he's a bastard. And I'm glad you feel that he is or was. Hopefully he no longer is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have to ask too, like based upon your history of, you know, eavesdropping in bars, like, did you actually meet Dennis Barton?
That's a question I really don't want to answer.
That's fine. You don't have to.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that might be giving away too many of the, you know, of the sorcerer's secrets.
Ooh, I love the mystery already.
Well, you know, there's another question I know you're going to ask me, and I don't know whether to wait for it or just tell you what I know you're going to ask me, which is, you know, how much of your stories are autobiographical, right?
So you're Dennis Barton.
I'm not saying that. Plausible deniability. You know, I, goddamn. Okay. Yes, I was Dennis Barton. How's that?
Wow.
Does that put another spin on the story?
It does. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now people are going to want to read the book now.
Yeah. And then think that I'm a horrible person.
No, not at all.
You know, also remember with these things that I do embellish because it is fact fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in a lot of those stories, there is, you know, I appear someplace, you know, in probably everything that I write. Now, I don't know if you've read On the Mountain, the mountain climbing story. You know, I'm obviously not either of those characters, although I did attempt Mount Hood once. So, you know, some of those stories have a lot less me, but there are some stories that have, you know, more me, too much me. And I'll say that, yeah, Dennis Barton is one of those. I don't know if I want to reveal any of the others.
Was it therapeutic to write that story?
Yes, it was. And the whole thing is that all happened a long time ago. That was an old, old thing. So I'm going to say probably 15 to 20 years ago is how old I, you know, in the little intro thing, I think with the book, I say that a lot of these characters have been with me for a long time. And he's not one of the oldest, but he was, you know, he's certainly there. I have read that story aloud at a couple of readings, and it always gets interesting reactions. And a lot of people don't know how to take it, or, you know. But we all have these moments in our lives, right?
Mm-hmm. We're human.
Maybe. Maybe it's just me. I still think that the title is right. I mean, in that context, Dennis Barton is a bastard in that context. And should not have done the things he was doing. It sounds like I just blew your mind on all this.
You did it in the best possible way. Because I think that there is truth to be told in art.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way than to reveal the truth of oneself in the pursuit of telling stories?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. I'm enjoying this conversation. Even though you put me on the spot, it was not a bad spot.
Okay.
You know, good. I mean, it was a good spot. It was a good spot to be.
Good. Well, one of the things that intrigued me, well, it didn't intrigue me, it surprised me, was when I started reading the book, you know, I first read several of your nonfiction books, so I was expecting, you know, a bunch of nonfiction stories, and then to reveal that they were fiction stories, I was like, whoa, you know, what, you know? So it's just like, how do you keep growing and evolving as an artist?
I believe that if you don't grow or evolve, then you're doomed to do the same thing, which I would find really boring. Should I say I enjoy making myself uncomfortable?
Really?
I enjoy exploring new stuff. Because, you know, there's some other stories there that were not the most comfortable to write. In my last book of short stories, which I will send you, From Arowana to Mule Shoe, there's a story in there about my heart surgeries, mm-hmm. which was really tough to write. Mm-hmm. Also therapeutic. But if you look at, you know, my book Road Dog, which I know you've read, you know, writing about what happens in the end, you know, that's some of the hardest stuff that I've ever had to write. Very emotional. And, you know, I think why wouldn't any artist push themselves in that direction and push themselves to grow? I think that sometimes we get spoiled and want our artists to keep doing the same thing. When I went from short films to features, you know, I got so much shit about, why don't you make funny little movies anymore? You know, we like your funny movies. Why are you dealing with some things that, you know, have elements of humor but are much more serious? And, you know, and I felt like I had done all that I could say with the short stuff and the funny stuff. And I had other things that were on my mind. And I think with the short fiction, you know, there are some funny stories in there. There's some less funny stories in there, you know, and just finding my, you know, I fumble my way through all this stuff. You know, I don't know if anybody sits down and says, okay, I'm going to move forward today. I'm going to, you know, do something I haven't done before. But a couple of friends of mine who have written, you know, some books that I really like, I feel like reading their stuff and knowing them gave me permission to push myself and go to different places that I ordinarily wouldn't do. I don't know if you've read the last story in the book, Mr. Pfeiffer.
Not yet, no.
Yeah, that is a story that I really pushed. I feel like my own, a lot of stuff about myself and my own work, I feel like I pushed that to a different level. And it's loosely based on both my grandfather and step-grandfather and my uncle, because I never knew either of my grandfathers. But I heard these stories, and so that became, you know, this whole impetus for that. And, you know, I can remember reading some stories by a friend of mine, Heath Dollar, who's a writer out of Texas. And some of his stories, you know, kind of gave me permission to go down some of those paths. I think that the story about It's No Sin to Be Lonely, which is the one about the woman in the bar, I don't know if I would have written that 5 years ago. And you know, that's another story that I really like. But as a bunch of my friends said, do not start the collection with that story. And I said, you know, because it's not very good. And I said, oh, no, it's really good. It's just kind of sad. And it's like, oh, okay. Don't start this collection with a sad story. I get it. But, you know, and also trying to figure out what stories go where. That was a lot harder than I thought it would be.
How did you approach that?
The way a friend of mine, I used to approach his film festival. I mean, think about, you know, you want to have something funny, something serious, you want to end on this, you want to do, you know. And so really I tried to mix up the stories so that, you know, if you read one that seemed kind of sad or whatever, well, then the next one hopefully will perk you up.
Take you to Amsterdam.
There is that. Yeah. Ah, I love this interview. and I do say that sincerely, because like I said, you are cracking me up when you're, you know, mentioning some of this stuff. And it's like, oh yeah, that that story. But other questions before I start, you know, losing it over here.
Go for it. Lose it.
Okay. Well, it all has to do with the stuff that you're asking me. I'm going for water right now.
Okay.
So
I can feel you blushing over the internet,
which doesn't happen often. But you did love the story.
I did. Yeah. It puts you in that place, and even that feeling of the way you described the other gentleman, and then the feeling of inadequacy is all I'll say.
Yeah.
I think we've all been in that position.
Yeah. Okay, now you're going to have to tell me some stories if you've been in that position.
Well, not like that.
No, I guess I'm being more specific. No, good answer.
I love talking around a story.
I know. But I was going to say, when it comes to inadequacy and all that other stuff, you know, I write what I know. you know, and that's... you know, when I'm around people I really care about, especially, you know, it's like if it's a female I'm interested or whatever it is, you know, I'm the biggest dolt and I don't know how to put sentences together and I overthink everything. And, you know, and I guess maybe that's one of the things that helps me as a writer, but it certainly messes me up as a human being. but yeah, and so you can already guess my answer to the Amsterdam story was, yeah, a lot of that is true. Yeah, some of the shit you can't make up.
Well, that's why you have to ask that question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, it's what I think the thing that's funny for me sometimes is when people read a story or, you know, read some of my stuff, or say, the things that they think are the most outrageous that they're sure I made up are the things that were true. And they never guess what I've embellished, but they always think that, you know, oh, you had to have made that up. And it's like, oh no, not that. I wish I was that good. But yeah, like I said, people's reactions are always interesting. And, you know, we're supposed to say, oh, I don't listen to what people say. I don't listen. You know, of course we do. We're human. You know, you want everybody to like your stuff. But if they don't, you know, then I can say, okay, well, they don't like it. And hopefully, you know, I walk away from that. but, you know, I think deep down, any artist who says, I don't care what people think, what people think, I think that they're lying on some level.
How have you learned to separate yourself between, you know, who you are as the artist and what people say about your work?
Because the work is not me. In that you might hate a character, you might think a character is a bastard, you know, but it's not me. I you know, I like to think I'm a pretty good person. Now, there are elements of me there. But, you know, I think what I do when people are critical, especially to my face, which some people seem to love to do, but I divorce myself and say, this is something I've created. This is not me. They have a problem with something that I have created. Okay, I can listen to that and say that's valid or that's not valid, and you're bringing your own experiences in and dumping them on my story, my character, whatever. But at the end of the day, I like to think that I'm still a good person, or a reasonably good person anyway. But I learned long ago that everybody's going to have an opinion. And if you start listening to everybody, you know, you get 90, you get 100 opinions on something. 99 think that you walk on water, and one is just kind of, eh, what is the one we remember? We remember the one that was not glowing. It might have been just neutral. And you're thinking, oh God, what have I done? And so, like I say, I have worked hard over the years, and I think I've put enough stuff out over the years that I just really have learned to separate myself from it. And, you know, we talk about, there's part of me in all these stories. Of course there are, there is, because I think that's where you write from. But none of those stories are me. None of those characters are completely me. And I don't think good artists ever reveal themselves totally. You always have to keep something back for yourself, I think. I do anyway.
I love that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the only way you can do it and stay sane.
Yeah, because I just love the notion that if you don't reveal everything, that gives you the freedom to grow and evolve throughout your entire career, not just being, you know, the flash in the pan, 15 minutes of fame.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I hope so. I mean, although I love, someday I'm going to find out what that 15 minutes of fame is all about. But I think just to stay sane, you have to keep stuff for yourself. I mean, don't you agree?
I do. I do agree with that.
But we reveal bits and pieces, and I think that that's good enough. And people who reveal too much, I think it's bad for them, not necessarily for the audience, but it's bad for their mental health.
Do you have an example of someone who has revealed too much? It doesn't have to be like someone you know or anything, but just like an artist that we can look at and be like, yeah, that's a good example of too much.
I think the easiest way is to look at any kind of reality television.
True.
You know, a lot of those people on those shows should not be on those shows. As an artist, I can't think of anybody off the top of my head. And part of it is, you know, because with so many artists, there's also the myth, Kerouac writing the whole On the Road, you know, one take and all this stuff, you know. So, you know, how do you separate the myth from? So I don't know if other artists have revealed too much. Can you think of anybody?
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my mind around it, but yeah. You know, but now I'm stuck in thinking about the myths of the artist and yeah. And like the myth of, you know, was it, you know, Jon Favreau writing like the script in The Weeknd?
Right.
Or, I don't know.
Right, right.
And put in the director who blew us all away.
Right, right. I mean, who, you know, is that stuff really true, or is that just the way they're selling it?
Right.
So, like I said, and I don't know, I want to think that artists who are good don't give it all away. And if they do, then they're probably kind of a one-hit wonder. I mean, once we've looked behind the curtain, do we want to see more, you know?
Now, is that referring to the Amsterdam story again?
I'm not sure. Where are you taking me on this? Where are you taking me on this?
We're on a journey, Kelly. We're on a journey.
That we are. You know, there were, you know, in Amsterdam, that story is a semi-documentary. I don't know how much it revealed.
Semi?
Yeah. Well, you know, I changed names. How's that? Now, I can't remember the names of the people in that story. maybe I shouldn't have included that story, but you liked it. So I guess, you know, I'm all in on that. You liked it. So I must have, it should have been good to include. There's another Amsterdam story coming up.
You know, I've liked all the stories I've read so far.
Yeah. Where good. Should I ask where you are?
I think I, the last story that I read was Dennis Barton is a Bastard.
Okay. So okay.
Is that the first third?
Yeah. First third. Yeah. You got more slogging to do. Hopefully none of it is slogging.
It's not. None of it is a slog.
Yeah. I don't have a copy. Oh yeah, I do. Okay. I just reached over because I'm still waiting for decent proof. It's driving me nuts. I hate Ingram. I hate Amazon. I hate everybody. Okay. So yeah, no, yeah. Now I just want to see what you had read. And you haven't asked me any questions about Cosmic Andy.
Remind me of Cosmic Andy.
Yeah, that's the guy who works at the car wash. It's the guy with the voices in his head.
Ooh, yeah, I love that one.
I did a reading of that, and a public reading, and I didn't know, because I knew Cosmic Andy. I mean, I knew this guy, and I built the story around him. He, you know, he did hear voice and stuff. I didn't know him well, but... you know, I built that story around that in early 70s Portland and all these places that used to be downtown, all those SRO hotels where, you know, old laborers just, you know, sat around all day waiting to die. But I read this at I did a reading, and one I didn't think was going to be, I thought it was going to be physically hard to read, to do all the voices and to keep it going. But I didn't realize it got real emotional to me while I was reading it. With all the voices in his head. But I finished, and this woman came up to me and she was like, "Oh my God, I knew him."
Wow.
And it's like, "Say what?" And she started telling me these things about this same character who I barely knew. And she said, "You hit all this stuff so right." And, you know, the guy is probably dead now. He said he had severe mental illness and I felt bad. But to have her come up and just, she was blown away. And that really affected me. That, you know, she knew this character that the story is based on. I don't know if I'll ever read that one again live, if that makes sense to you.
Well, it does. And at the same time, what a powerful way to honor that person.
Yeah. And you know, so many of those, because a bunch of the stories are, you know, old history for me. I mean, there's stuff that, you know, occurred when I was 18, 19, 20, those things. And, you know, some of those stories are in there. And part of this is, and, you know, I deal with this or fight with this all the time. You know, I'm born and raised here in Portland, but this isn't my hometown anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different place. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes, you know, when I'm writing about some of these things, usually someplace I mention a year, or I mentioned something so people don't think that this is modern times. Mm. Because my Portland is different than most people's, especially today. And you know, I worry about people not understanding it or not. Because, you know, when was the last time you saw a whole bunch of SRO, you know, single room occupancy hotels for these old pensioners? And they're all sitting, you know, in chairs around a lobby watching a black and white TV, and basically they're sitting there waiting to die. You know, their bodies are broken, they have no families. And, you know, we don't have that here anymore. We don't have those, you know, and sometimes I feel like I'm a little out of time because I lived through all that stuff, and that a lot of that stuff is still real vibrant and still in my head. But you know, where, I don't know if it exists anymore.
Just moved to tents on I-5.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of those people are younger people, and a lot of them, you know, have some kind of mental illness and stuff. But I remember these old guys, they were just worn out, you know, and they would get their Social Security, which would basically probably, you know, cover the monthly rent on the place. And literally, you know, you see, and, you know, the weathered faces and the canes and walkers and wheelchairs. You know, and like I said, as an 18-year-old, 19, 20-year-old, I mean, that stuff had an impact on me then. I think it's probably got a greater impact on me now. But, you know, those are the things that I guess I feel I have to write about. Other times, other places, and other people. But all of those old guys fascinated me.
Would you say that in a way, as you're writing these stories, you're trying to find home again?
Oh, I think that's a given, but I also think that I know there is no home anymore. Home's gone, you know? And so I think consciously, I might be trying to find home, trying to find another time, or thinking and dwelling on it, because I mind the past, but I certainly don't live in it. You know, I like so much more of this newer Portland than the old one. There's certain things I like about it, obviously. But yeah, maybe I'm looking for a grounding, because I can drive through my old neighborhood and it's not my neighborhood. It has not been for years. And very few of the landmarks are still there. And like I said, I'm okay with that. It's not one of these, oh gosh, I wish we could go back to those times. They were simpler. No, they weren't. You know, they had their own pain. They had their own horrors. No. And, you know, what people want to go back to is an idealized time that never actually really happened. I think I'm very much in the present and looking forward to the future.
Mm, that's powerful.
Well, but a lot of my characters don't do that. You know, I mean, a lot of my characters are stuck in the past. I mean, you've seen that with some of the stories, and there'll be more stories where, you know, they can't escape the past, or they're longing for something. Or they wanted things to turn out differently, but they didn't make the right decisions. Mm. And I think that's something that people do. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, we want to achieve this thing, we want to do this thing, but we make all the wrong decisions, and then we're shocked that we don't get there. Or we're too afraid to make those decisions.
Yeah. I mean, fear is potent.
Yeah, change is scary. But I think that, because when you talk about, you know, moving forward as an artist, that is scary, or can be scary, but it's important. You know, we all need to change. We all need to grow, to we hopefully better ourselves, to open ourselves up to new and different things.
And I know you mentioned this earlier, where, you know, you don't want to be stuck and you want to keep growing, but mm-hmm. like, how do you not get stuck in your own ways, in your old ways, in your current ways, and just kind of stagnate?
I guess you have to consciously change it up. You have to, you know, break some old patterns. You know, for me, I did not intend to write a book of short stories. I intended to write a novel. And I got about 150 pages into the novel and got absolutely slammed, stuck in, against a wall. And so, you know, remembering that when I was making films, I started making short films. And then before I graduated to features, so I thought, you know what, I need to learn this form. I need to. So I think I'll try a couple of short stories. And I read somewhere Ray Bradbury said, you know, you should do a short story a week for a year. By the end of the year, you know, you're going to have a few good ones. And so I kind of took that as my mantra and started writing short stories. And, I mean, you know, within 4 weeks, I'd figured out the problem with the novel, but I have not gone back to the novel. Because I've become, you know, I've got, I think I've got another 25 short stories that I'm in various stages on. And so half of me says, you know, why don't I finish up these stories? And part of it is because I know I'm getting, you know, every story you write, you hope you get better. at storytelling. And so, but I think you have to force yourself to change things up. You have to say, I'm going to do something that I haven't done before. And if I fail, well, nobody's going to know. And hopefully I'll learn something from it. You know, I mean, because when you're a writer, you're not flailing out in public unless they publish it. Mm-hmm. But since I control all my own publishing, you're not going to see my bad stuff. You know, but I will learn from it.
Yeah. And I think there's so much in what you just said about just pushing yourself to grow and learn, mm-hmm. no matter what age you are. And I take so much inspiration from that because I do not want to lose that spirit.
No.
As I get older.
No, we have to stick together on that. I mean, you know, because when you talk to people who haven't read a book in 37 years, you know, it's like, oh, I haven't read since college. Or I haven't read. It's like, why not?
That's,
you know, it's worlds to escape. My granddaughter now is going to a Spanish immersion daycare. She's like 18 months old.
Oh, wow.
I'm teaching myself Spanish. I have an app for the phone and I'm going to learn so that, you know, I can talk and speak Spanish with her. You know, and it's, to me, that's just another cool thing to learn.
Yeah.
You know, why not learn another language?
Ah, I love that. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it keeps our brains young. And, you know, honestly, I had two parents who both, you know, had dementia and one went from dementia to Alzheimer's. I fear that, you know, I do not want to lose my brain, my mind. And so, you know, the more things, new experiences, the more new things I learn, the better.
Yeah. My grandfather had Alzheimer's, so I know exactly that fear of not wanting to lose your mind.
Well, and, you know, having conversations with my parents, when they would have those moments of clarity, when they knew they had dementia, they knew they couldn't remember, they knew, and how it frustrated them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's pretty scary too, watching someone flail, if you will, wrestling with that. You know, because what we want to say is, well, they've got dementia, they don't remember. But they have moments, I think, when they do. And to me, that's worse.
Yeah. Whew.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a funny conversation, wasn't it? Damn it, Chris.
But it's good. I mean,
I know.
This is the stuff that you want to talk about. This is great.
No, like I said, I'm loving this. I like all of our conversations, you know, I mean, because I learn a lot from you in all this stuff too. So,
well, one of the things, Kelly, that I wholeheartedly support and appreciate is the fact that you wave the flag for independent artists, and especially in a time where the conglomerates are winning. I love the fact that there are people out there that are tried and true independent artists. So how can people better understand and support people like yourself, people like me, people like all our friends who are those independent artists?
You know, what I'm telling people now, especially with this new book, is, you know, if I post something to social media, if I, you know, write something about the book, you know, whatever it is, share it. Sharing an artist's work, sharing, you know, what they're doing, who they are, costs nothing, right? But to that artist, if people start sharing my posts about the book, or, hey, I can't afford this book, but look at this cool thing that somebody, you know, wrote, and get away from Amazon, right? I got real problems with Amazon. And with this promo that we just shot, you know, one of the things I tell people too is my books are available on Amazon. But that's for you. That's not for me. That's for your convenience. I would really appreciate it if you came to my website, bought it from me. I don't even buy my books from Amazon anymore. I get them from Ingram. And I pay more per book than I would if I bought them through Amazon. So maybe I'm stupid. But I dislike Jeff Bezos so much. Because all he does is he takes other people's work, and some of these other, you know, companies do too. They take other people's work and profit from them. What have they added mm-hmm. to any of this?
Right.
And so my whole thing in raising the flag and all this other stuff is be aware that there are people in your neighborhood, in, you know, your block, in your city, that are doing really cool things. And if there's a way to buy from them directly, that benefits them more directly. But ultimately, I think it benefits you too, supporting to have a strong, vibrant community around you, mm-hmm. whether you're an artist or not. And so this is where I think, once again, it comes to the whole thing. We have social media. We have these amazing things. And how are we using them? Well, we're using them to be really critical of every fucking thing coming down the planet. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'll use it to be critical of Bezos and Amazon, but that's different. No.
That is different.
So do as I say, not right. But use your social media stuff to turn people on to new, cool stuff. And if you read a book or see a movie and it's not your cup of tea, you don't have to go out there and roast it, because someone very close to you might really like that. And you can say, well, they're an idiot or whatever it is, but that's not true. No, we all have different tastes. But if you support independent musicians, support independent writers, filmmakers, painters, you know, I subscribe to a bunch of local musicians, their Patreon accounts, I mean, all these other things. You know, I can't spend very much money, you know, my $5, $10 a month, how much is that really helping? But, you know, that's $5 and $10 that's going directly to them.
For sure.
And I think that that's important. It's kind of like, you know, when we were kids growing up, the local pizza place would sponsor the Little League team. Or mm-hmm. the, you know, I mean, you had these small businesses, and these small businesses are gone. They've been consumed. But there's nothing that says we need to be consumed by all these corporate giants. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm a throwback or something, but, you know, I still buy locally as much as I possibly can. You know, I do have to deal with Amazon just to stock my stuff. But I always tell people, go someplace else. I'm working right now to upgrade my website so that people can download the ebooks off of my site. You don't have to go to Kindle, or you don't have to go to these places, because it turns out one of the plugins I use can do that.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm working hard at trying to put more stuff back, you know, onto my site, onto my plate, which means I have to promote more, mm-hmm. you know, and do more things. But I've got to work a little harder. But ultimately, I feel bad knowing people are sending all this money to Jeff Bezos. People used to say, you know, oh, we're not going to have your books here in this bookstore. We're not going to promote you because, you know, you're with Amazon. And I used to say, Amazon is a printer. They're not my publisher. I'm the publisher.
Right.
Amazon provides a service, which is to print the books. But Amazon and all these other corporations have us so convinced that they're the providers. They're the content people. Whereas they're just hosting content. They're not. What has Bezos ever created mm-hmm. besides a website where you can get all this shit? You know, and that's true, not, you
and
know.
Sell the byproduct of all of the servers.
Yes, absolutely. And mark it up. And he wants exclusive, right? And so, you know, I keep preaching the gospel of independence. And I say, you know, there's some people I support who I'm kind of lukewarm about their art, but they're doing stuff. And they're making it happen. And I want to encourage that. And, you know, as you're encouraging, you hope that things get better. They do better, you know. But we are becoming a nation, really, of consumers. And, we are a nation of consumers. But the craftspeople and the artists and all this other stuff, we're losing them. And I don't want those people to go. And so, you know, I printed a thing on my website, and it's up on my Facebook page and stuff too, about, you know, six ways or seven ways you can help independent artists, and it doesn't cost you a dime, you know, and just go to Amazon and, you know, write a review of the book, right? Go to, you know, when you see something from a creator you like, forward it, you know, retweet it, send it all out there, open them up to more people. And I think that's the best you can do as far as supporting independence, because it doesn't have to be about money.
Right.
Right. And I think that's what some people forget.
Yeah.
you know, spread the word. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's, you know, some local musician, some local, you know, because there are times when I get emails back from people who have just discovered me.
That's awesome.
And they're so excited. And it's just like, that makes me feel good. You know, that makes my day.
Yeah.
So why not go out and make somebody else's day?
Yeah. Punk.
Yeah. Make my day, punk.
So speaking of your website, where is it?
Angryfilmmaker.com.
Nice.
Easy to find. I think on Instagram, I'm at angryfilmmaker. And of course, I'm on Facebook, Kelly Baker, or The Angry Filmmaker, both up there. And on Twitter, at Angry Filmmaker as well. I'm bad. I'm nationwide, nice. As ZZ Top would sing.
That's awesome. Well, Kelly, this has been such a fun conversation. Last question for you. What's blowing your mind right now as far as books or movies?
A lot of stuff. And of course, when you say that, everything goes out of my head. you know, because I've always got a couple of books going. And I can't, you know, right now I'm just trying to, it's like, oh my God, what am I reading? You know, I'm reading a bunch of local authors just because I know them. As far as, you know, films and podcasts, I've been kind of on a jag with the films and watching a lot of like classic films, some old Cary Grant stuff. And some stuff from the 60s that was, you know, really moved me back then. And I'm enjoying the hell out of that. I don't spend as much time watching television or listening to podcasts because my days are spent glued to the computer, either editing or sound designing, you know, for my films or for clients' work. And so I probably read more. And I probably got 5 different books going on right now. But they're all, like I say, you know, you ask me and poof, everything. I should have just lined everything up on my desk here, but they're all in the bedroom, you know. So I wish, you know, but I'm always looking for new stuff and different stuff. And I've got friends who, you know, send me books saying, whether it's theirs or somebody else's, you got to check this out. So I love that.
Ooh, well, I'll share one that I'm reading right now that I'm absolutely loving. It's Please. Called The New Farm by Brent Preston, I think. Okay. And it's about this guy who decides that he and his wife are going to start a farm in Canada.
Wow.
Yeah. Everything that they learned. It's great.
And they don't know anything, do they?
No, they don't. It's great.
Those are the best experiences, especially when you admit up front, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I really want to do this. And I think when you open yourself up to new experiences, you learn. Pure and simple.
As mentioned throughout the interview, be sure to head to angryfilmmaker.com to pick up Kelly's latest book, Dennis Barton is a Bastard and Other Stories. You'll also find links to all of his films, all of his other books, and all of the other awesome merch that he has branded with Angry Filmmaker. Speaking of supporting independence, did you know that I started an online community for creators, dreamers, storytellers, and do-gooders just like you? It's called Curiosity Builders, and it is a safe place to connect, learn, grow, and share. Sign up today for free at curiosity.builders or find the link in this episode's show notes at gwtw.co/548 to join the curious conversations with other independent artists. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.